Marking tomorrow, January 27th, which is designated as International Holocaust Memorial Day, the day 80 years ago that the Nazi concentration camp Auschwitz-Birkenau was liberated, today we light a candle of remembrance. Karen Moody, in her piece entitled Remembering Yom HaShoah, reminds us that on April 19, 1943, the Jewish community in the Warsaw Ghetto rose up against their captors in a valiant effort to regain their freedom and return a common humanity to those intent on destroying their very existence. Jews around the world pay tribute to Yom HaShoah on the 27th of Nisan, a day commemorating what we call the Holocaust. Shoah means literally catastrophe. We light a candle because anytime life is annihilated, we are all diminished. This light reminds us that we hold both the responsibility and privilege to live lives that work in pursuit of justice for all, but especially for those who are marginalized and oppressed. We work for those whose stories we have not yet heard enough to change our hearts and our way of living. These words scratched into a wall in Auschwitz remind us to listen further still that we might remember. I believe in the sun even when it's not shining. I believe in love even when I don't feel it. Believe in God even when silent. For all those intentions which rest in the silent sanctuary of our hearts, may the white light of this flame burn brightly and bring you peace. Let us hold this flame of remembrance and also the fire of resistance to oppression in our hearts. Tomorrow, as we have just noted, through the ritual of a candle lighting, is International Holocaust Remembrance Day. It and Yom HaShoah are two different days of remembrance. Tomorrow marks when the Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration camp was liberated by the Allies. It recognizes not only the devastating millions of dead, but also those who survived to share with us what it was really like during the Nazi regime. People like the quilting artists that we heard about during the Time for All Ages. The springtime remembrance of Yom HaShoah, literally meaning the catastrophe, commemorates the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, an act of resistance by the Polish Jews who'd been forced into a forerunner of the confinement and death of the concentration camps. These two holy days in the Jewish calendar are bittersweet. They're not holidays, they are holy days. They recognize the mixed nature of blessings we experience in our lives. They mark significant events in the history of humanity. The origins of the word history include from the Greek histor, meaning learned, wise man, and historia, meaning inquiry, narrative, account. But it is also related to the word wit, and therefore the German word wissen, which is the verb to know. I bring up these details because inherent in history and its meaning is the word story, which has been the worship theme for this month. And I want to consider resistance as an integral part of story in general, and our personal stories in particular. I will start with the particular, sharing some stories about my family, and go on from there into thoughts and questions about the place of resistance in our lives and current social and political contexts in this 21st century. Things aren't all that different from a century ago, which is both catastrophe and blessing. I am predominantly German-American. There is some Scots-Irish on my mother's side of the family, in other words, Presbyterians, who emerged early in the Protestant Reformation. Note the word Protestant, Protestant. The Protestants resisted the complete domination of the Roman Catholic Church in matters of religious practice and political dictates. Among my maternal great-grandmother's direct ancestors were Puritan dissenters who were part of the New Haven Compact, arriving in what is now Connecticut in 1638 to found an English colony for free religionists. Unitarian Universalists arose out of the Protestant Reformation. We are part of what is known as the Radical Reformation, the far more progressive outgrowths of the evolving and branching Protestant Church. This morning, however, I am going to focus on my father's side of the family. This part of my history is very much wrapped up in the events that occurred in Germany in the early to mid 20th century. As such, I should note a content or trigger warning. There are parts of this family history that may be hard to hear for some of us. My father and his brothers were born in Germany in the 1920s. Their paternal grandparents had converted from Judaism at the time of their marriage in the late 19th century, which was actually a common occurrence. This practice may have been a way that Jews assimilated into German society, I don't know. At any rate, they adopted the German Lutheran faith. Both families had been part of the lower social classes, serfs and street people, as their names Lehmann and Strassmann respectively indicated. My father's grandfather, Leo, had been a lawyer. His grandmother, Henny, was an artist and writer active in social reforms, including women's suffrage, social democratic governance, and she served as a delegate to the Weimar Republic, an early form of democracy in Germany. My dad's father, Carl, was an archaeologist, and his aunt, Eva, was a linguist specializing in ancient languages, such as Etruscan. Both were academics. Both were outspoken critics of the road down which Germany was traveling. As such, and with Jewish roots, they both lost their positions early after Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. This forced Karl to take his family in 1934 to Italy, initially, although we know that things didn't turn out to be any better there under Mussolini than in Germany under the Nazi regime. The family came back to Germany and then immigrated to the United States in 1935. Meanwhile, the man that Eva had married joined the Nazi party as part of her resistance. Eva divorced and took her preteen daughter, Ruth, also to the United States. Back in Germany, Henny Strassmann Lehmann was stripped of her rights and her property due to her Jewish roots. When diagnosed with cancer in 1937, she chose to take her own life rather than die slowly and painfully without access to medical treatment. Her daughter Eva also received a cancer diagnosis in 1937. And when she died, her daughter went to live with my dad's family in New York. As you can imagine, the current resurgence of fascism, comparisons of American political leaders to Adolf Hitler, the penchant to obey in advance, as well as stripping people of our basic rights under American democracy that mirror the tactics of the 1930s and 1940s National Socialist Party, bring to my mind my family's story in the larger context of European and world history. Last summer, I picked up and read a copy of Jessica Shattuck's 2017 novel, The Women in the Castle, in which the author explores the complicated and nuanced relationships of some German women during and immediately following World War II. The book tells the story of a few women who were wives of men involved in the larger German resistance movement. It also includes a German woman who was connected to the others, but espoused beliefs that supported Nazism. I read it with particular interest because the story, while not an historical novel in the sense of being directly about specific real life individuals, uses as its basis for the characters actual women involved in one way or another with a particular resistance group. And my family is connected to that group. In fact, Shattuck lists as a resource the memoir of a woman I came to know about 40 to 45 years ago, Memories of Kreisau and the German Resistance. Freya von Moltke was the wife of Graf Count Helmut von Moltke, who was the co-director of the Kreisauer Kreis, Kreisau Circle, a group of men and one woman who came from the professional classes and landed gentry. Kreisau was the estate of the von Moltke family, and the group met there only a few times, actually. They were not focused on violent overthrow of the Nazi regime or the assassination of Hitler, but rather their discussions looked to the future, to the re-establishment of a democratic government once Hitler was defeated. How did I come to know Freya von Moltke? Well, one of the other women living in the castle, the Kreisau Schloss, was really more of a large manor house situated on a farm in Silesia, was a cousin of mine, the wife of another one of the resistors. Her name was Rosemarie Reichwein. She was married to Adolf Reichwein, a professor at one of the Berlin universities and a social democrat. Romy, as she was affectionately called, and her children left Berlin and survived the end of the war and its aftermath near the Polish border at Kreisau with Freya and others. She then returned to Berlin and became an early physiotherapist. Romy connected me with Freya, who had immigrated to the US following the war and lived in Vermont, where I visited her during my years in Massachusetts and Maine. Romy's husband was executed in October 1944 as a member of the Kreis. Although it included pacifists, the Kreisauer Kreis eventually did become involved in what is commonly known as the 20th of July 1944 assassination attempt, or the so-called briefcase bombing, carried out by Colonel Klaus von Stauffenberg. Klaus was part of the military conspiracy against Hitler, and his cousin Peter York von Wartenburg was the other co-director of the Kreisau Kreis. Count York von Wartenburg was also executed, along with many others, for their tangential connection to the coup attempt and their resistance efforts. Peter's wife, Marion York von Wartenburg, was the only woman directly involved in the Kreisau Kreis activities. Although the other women, to one degree or another, knew about it and what it hoped to accomplish. Marion also stayed in Germany following the war, practicing law, as her husband had, and becoming a criminal judge. She also wrote a memoir, The Power of Solitude, My Life in the German resistance. I have so much respect for these and the many others who stood up against the violence being done in Hitler's Germany. All three women survived. They also all lost husbands and friends who died in a fight for justice and freedom, that peace might prevail. I saw a meme not long ago posted by one Zeli Imani that says, "For the oppressed, peace is the absence of oppression, but for the oppressor, peace is the absence of resistance." I do believe that old adage that says, "Where one of us is not free, none of us are free." In other words, if anyone is oppressed, all of us are oppressed. For all of us, then, we will not experience peace until oppression is erased from human society. And because this goes against, resists the aims of the oppressor, we must all engage in forms of resistance. In the UUA's Worship Web resources, there is a story titled "Someone for Peace, a Story About Emily Green Balch," written by Denise Tracy. Emily Green Balch is one of our Unitarian forebears. She, along with her friend, Settlement House founder Jane Addams, whose name you recognize, decided that someone must do something about ending the First World War. So in 1915, without the permission of the United States government, they visited 14 countries, interviewing 22 prime ministers, the presidents of two republics, one king, and one pope. They talked with them all about peace and ending the war. They said, "Someone must do something, and this time the someone is us. What will you do to ensure peace?" Each of the Cries Our Christ women that I shared about had a different way of resisting. My cousin Romy Reichwein was not directly involved in the resistance activities, but she made certain that she and her children survived. In the long run, she devoted her life to helping people to heal physically. Marion York von Wartenberg was intimately involved in the work of the group, and as a lawyer and criminal judge, she always tried to do justice to both humanity and to the judicial office. This was still a time when many men were absolutely against women in judicial matters. Freya von Moltke's role was somewhere in between the non-involved and the deeply embedded. Freya lived almost exclusively at the Kreisau estate once it was too dangerous to live in Berlin. She took over running the farm. She made sure that people had food to eat, even when they couldn't pay for it or make a barter exchange. And she provided a safe, sheltering place to live, not just for her co-resistors, but also for the people who worked for her, regardless of their political views. Before her death in 2010, Freya and other friends of the resistance against dictatorships in Germany and in Poland have gotten together and have founded the Kreisau Foundation for European Understanding, which owns the farm complex and the barrack house. The governments have provided the means for the building renovation. Kreisau is to be designated again as a place for meetings, for speaking and listening, and above all, as a place where younger and older people can meet. Kreisau will now, should now, and can now promote a better coexistence in Europe. These women, and women such as Emily Green Balch and Esther Niesenthal-Krinitz, the quilter who Ann Richards introduced to us, inspire me. And as an aside, I am so pleased to know that I can go see Esther's quilts in Baltimore in June when I attend the UUA's General Assembly. And talk about inspiration. Attending a large gathering of Unitarian Universalists is tantamount to inspiration for me. If you can go to Baltimore for the 200th anniversary celebrations of the Unitarian lineage of our faith, do so. You'll see and meet firsthand all sorts of inspiration. Anyway, the life stories of the women who resisted inspire me. Who are you inspired by? Perhaps Bishop Marianne Buddy? Are there stories in your own families that have set an example for you? What stories have you heard that prompt you to resist, to fight against oppression and for peace? Are you making an extra effort to learn about history or current events? How have you embodied peace? Have you protested and marched? Do you attend online gatherings? Have you made visual art, written or shared yours or others' stories through poetry, prose, and song? Let us take a few minutes before we bring this worship service to a close to turn and share with the people sitting closest to us one way that we have resisted oppression and worked for peace and justice. If that means turning to a family member, that's okay, but maybe share with them something you haven't shared before. If it feels too challenging to come up with a brief story, then speak aloud a commitment about something you can do to resist oppression during this time of particular uncertainty and outright fear in our country and in our world. Please give each person in your intimate vicinity a chance to speak. It doesn't have to be long. It doesn't have to be a detailed story. The highlights will suffice to get the ball rolling. I invite you now to turn to those close to you. I will ring a chime when it's time to come back together. I hope each of you heard at least one nugget of inspiration during this time of sharing. Please know that none of us can manage to do all of the things that constitute resistance. That would not be a fair expectation. But each of us can do something that is within our capabilities. Maybe that's as simple as sharing our stories.